நீங்கள் SBS தமிழோடு இணைந்துள்ளீர்கள்.
In this interview with me, Kulasekaram Sanjayan, lawyer and poet Maitri Panagoda reflects on his life journey from Sri Lanka to Australia following the publication of his poetry collection, Purple Patch. He speaks about his early struggles as a migrant lawyer, his long legal career working with Aboriginal communities, and how poetry became both a creative outlet and a source of balance. A thoughtful conversation about justice, memory, and the power of words. Greetings, Mr. Maitri Panagoda.
Thank you, Sanjayan.
First, congratulations on your recent book launch, book of poetry titled Purple Patch. When I was there at the Glebe Books, someone commented that they had never seen a crowd like that for a book launch.
Thank you very much. That's in line with the feedback I'm getting from a number of people who are in the industry as well as the bookshop itself. They said normal attendance is about 60 to 70 people. On this occasion, I think there were about 100 and they ran out of stock in the end. People had to go without being able to buy the book. Anyway, it's very pleasing.
We know that you were born in Sri Lanka. You got your primary and secondary education there. Then you went to the UK. Tell us more about that, please.
I was born in a Sinhalese Buddhist village called Vatumulla, which is about 4 kilometers from Gampaha. And I had my education mainly in Ananda College, Colombo. I finished my A-levels and entered the law faculty. There was only one law faculty at the time in Colombo. It had been moved from Peradeniya to Colombo. Did my LLB there. We had some wonderful lecturers, Professor Nadaraja, Dr. Mark Kure, Dr. Sonaraja, and quite a few academics. And our batch was supposed to be one of the best. they are still talking about it because everyone did something different. And then I took my oaths as an advocate in 1975. But I have never practiced in Sri Lanka. I went straight to England for higher studies, mainly because I had two brothers and a sister there at that time. I wanted to study journalism, actually. I did 1 year at the London School of Journalism, and I had promised my father that I would be back in a year. But 50 years later, I'm still here. So in England, I did postgraduate studies, qualified as a lawyer, and then we got married and moved to Australia in 1981.
Did you work as a lawyer in the UK?
Yeah, for 3 years after qualifying, I worked as a lawyer. But before that, I did every menial job I could find to find money, security jobs, supermarket cleaning, did everything. Because those days, there were very strict exchange regulations and couldn't get money from Sri Lanka. That was a very good learning point. In Sri Lanka, we were middle-class families and there were domestic servants to do things. So I didn't even know how to make a cup of tea at the time I went to England. But it was really a training ground and I think I grew up in London in that sense of the word.
Why did you choose to come to Australia and not go back to Sri Lanka?
We wanted to go back. So we had one child. He was about 10 months old. We were often debating whether to go back or not. But then there were problems, communal issues and other issues. And a lot of people, not my family, but a lot of friends said, maybe not the right time to come back. Why don't you watch and wait? Maybe there will be a time of peace for you to come. But then we were not totally comfortable in England, the weather and other things. So actually, it was an accident. We were walking past the Australian High Commission in London, and there was a board saying it was an open day, saying, please come in and talk to us. So we went in, and they gave us a form. We completed it and forgot about it. About a month later, we got an invitation for an interview. So it worked like that, and then we got the visa. And came to Australia in August 1981, not knowing anyone, a single person here. I had no contacts. So we had to work from the very bottom, again doing all kinds of jobs initially, although I had my qualifications. So it was good, quite proud about all that work I did those days.
You came to Australia by chance, you said. Tell us more about your early days in Australia. You couldn't find a job as a lawyer. So
yes.
How did you go about overcoming that?
We were in Sydney from August, I think about 3 months. I had sent 42 applications for vacancies. For each one, I was fully qualified. I was probably overqualified for some. I got about 5 interviews in law firms, and I'm pretty sure I did well at the interviews. But then you get a letter saying, unfortunately, because you don't have local experience, we can't offer you anything. I think there was a bit of racism at the time. Very disappointed, but then suddenly I saw an advertisement for a position with the Western Aboriginal Legal Service in Dubbo. And I sent an application. Again, I didn't have any idea where Dubbo was or knew absolutely nothing about the indigenous people. But then I got a telephone call asking me to come for an interview to Dubbo. And in the meantime, the principal solicitor there came and actually visited us in Sydney. And he encouraged me to come and face the interview board. He was a white Australian lawyer. They were doing only criminal law. And he thought I could develop a practice in civil law. I don't know where he got the idea from, but that's what happened. And then went for the interview. The funny thing is I went in a full three-piece suit coming from England. And the interview board was, I think, 12 or 13 indigenous people plus this lawyer. They were all in shorts and thongs, some were T-shirts. And I felt a little bit out of place. So the interview went well. They asked me questions and offered me the job. That's how it all happened. We only had a few boxes of belongings and very little money. We put everything in a ute and went to Dubbo.
At that time, you had only the son or you had...
Only the son.
The First Nations people are not known for welcoming anyone into their clan or life.
Yeah.
And how did that go, your experience with them initially?
At that time, Sanjan, they were only used to seeing Indian doctors, that's doctors of our color, but not lawyers. So I was a bit of a different person they had to encounter. But very soon they were putting their arms around me and said, saying, you are one of us, brother, welcome, and all sorts of things. So after a little hesitation, they accepted us. We were so happy to be there. It was like living in Gampaha. After a while, everyone gets to know you. There were no other Sri Lankans. There was only one family. There was a doctor, but only other family. And made us very comfortable. The funny thing is, the third day of my first week, they asked me to go to Koba, local court, and appear for some people. I knew nothing about criminal law in Australia. In the car, I had to refresh my memory and learn a few things to say to the judge. But it was a successful day. And then I developed a practice in civil law, which became quite successful. And life took a very different meaning. We had planned to come back to Sydney after 6 months, but we were there for 10 years. So life was good. And the kids had a very good upbringing. They got to know different types of people, First Nations people. They learned the real history of Australia. So it's been a lifelong friendship since then with most of the Indigenous people.
Isn't the British legal system the same as Australians?
Very much. I mean, even Sri Lanka, New Zealand, South Africa, based on similar legal principles, but there are procedural differences. In Australia, each state has its own laws, and then the Commonwealth has common things. So there are differences, but basically the principles are the same.
Do you have any interesting or unforgettable moments that you could share from your experience in Dubbo?
I'm sure there are many. First of all, they couldn't pronounce my name, so I had a collection of names. They used to call me Pine Tree and that sort of thing instead of my tree. They were very, very sort of lovely people. This is something that the rest of Australia don't know, I think. That's why I think my kids are very privileged that way. They got to learn from them and mix with them and share with them their happiness and sorrows. So memory-wise, setting up the practice was a task, but I did it. There is one incident that comes to my mind. One unhappy Aboriginal litigant once burst into our office with a knife, wanting to kill all the lawyers. He barged in, the receptionist was screaming, and then she tried to stop him, but he managed to get through. And mine was the first office. So he came into my office wanting to kill a white lawyer, so to speak. He saw me and he said, "Ah, who are you?" I said, "This is my name, I'm Maitri." "You a lawyer?" I said, "Yes." "Oh, a black fellow, a lawyer." And then I said, "What's your problem, mate?" And then I said, "Sit down, take a seat." He sat down, still with the knife in his hand. I said, "Can you please put that knife away?" Which he did. And then he started crying. He had some grievance, and I was able to disarm him, talk to him. And we became friends, so no bloodshed. So that's an unforgettable experience, I think.
You are known for your work for or with the Stolen Generation.
Yeah.
We have done stories about the Stolen Generation in our Tamil program. And one listener once asked me, "Can you judge someone now based on the existing laws of that time where things were legal?"
Yeah. Well, the answer to that question is yes and no. I mean, whatever they did was legal. Taking away a child from the parents was made legal because of this white Australia policy and wanting to erase the black race. So they were not breaking the law. But what happened afterwards? Okay, if you take the kid, place the kid in a proper place, give him or her proper education, the opportunities the others have, that did not happen. That's why we call them stolen children. And I can tell you hundreds of stories of abuse and deprivation and so many kids. I mean, one example is there was a place called Kinchilla Boys Home where all the Aboriginal boys were taken. During the winter, they froze. In the morning, they were put to work about 5 in the morning in freezing weather. And one person told me that he used to go near the cattle and wait for them to, he wanted to find a fresh cow dung so that he could warm his feet. So that level of deprivation, we have told these stories before and never been denied. And kids were treated very badly. The boys were brought up to be farm hands, laborers. Girls were trained to be housemaids and domestic workers. So from a very live culture, 50,000 years old, proud people suddenly reduced to nothing. That's where the illegality, that's where it was wrong.
There are some political parties claiming that we don't have to do anything for the mistakes done by past governments or officials. What is your take on that?
I've heard these arguments. Some people still say that slavery was okay at the time and that we shouldn't be talking about it anymore. But slavery was bad, whether it was legal or not. Keeping people as unpaid workers, as property was wrong. So some people will never understand that. It's a bit like nowadays, making big noises that all Australia's problems are because of migrants. Whereas, without migrants, this country would be nothing. So I don't accept that view at all. If they are happy to inherit the good things from the past, they should also inherit the bad things and take responsibility for what's happened. There are many stories of mass killings of Aboriginal people. There was a massacre, I forget the name now, at one place where they just shot all the Aboriginal people. Kids were sexual assaults, abuse, that sort of thing. So,
were you talking about Myall Creek Massacre?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Myall Creek Massacre. So history cannot be ignored. We have to learn from the history and we have to accept the wrongs. That's the only way you can address the issues for the future.
Valid point that you are raising by saying if you are able to enjoy the good things, you should also take the responsibility for the bad things. And
Exactly. Nicely put.
I think we can go on talking about that work of yours for a very long time, but we are constrained by time. Sure. I would like to talk about your literary work. You have already published 4 CDs of songs. and nine publications so far, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
And your latest publication, The Purple Patch, a collection of poems. Some of them are very moving and heart-wrenching. And it was a delight to see your grandchildren read some of the poems. Did you train them to do that?
Or? No, they didn't even tell me. They chose the poems themselves and discussed with their parents, that's my children. And they practiced, apparently. And my daughter, she's the mother of three girls. She asked me, Dad, do you want them to recite it before you? I said, no, I'd rather listen to it for the first time. So that was the very first time I heard them reciting them. And it was very moving. I had to keep my emotions under control.
My ears were to them, but my eyes were looking at what you were doing. I could see the pride and joy oozing out of your face.
Yeah, they're all lovely kids. You know, the little girl, she's now 7. She recently said to me, they call me Sia. Sia, it's wrong, isn't it, that people just come to this country and say, this is our country, and then take over? So she was talking about, 200 years ago, the British coming and claiming it as their own country. So she could understand it because the parents explained to them what happens in this country. So it was a moving moment for me to listen to them.
It may not be politically correct for me to say it, but the understanding this 7-year-old has, some of the politicians here don't have. So,
yeah, unfortunately. I think they do understand, but they, for other reasons, they take a different view, I think.
I'm sure you had been asked many times before, and you talked about that at the book launch as well. How do you find the time to write?
That's my main problem, finding time. I just stepped down from the partnership, but during the 30 years or so when I was a partner, it was very, very tough finding time because very demanding job. I had a team of 21 people and you had to supervise them, you had to see clients and give advice, do all those things. So you are exhausted at the end of the day, but you have to find a way to deal with it. And mine was writing poetry mainly. That's what I did. Writing a poem is not something you can say, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, I'm going to sit down and write a poem. It doesn't work like that. You can't go and search for a poem. It has to come to you. And it can come to you when you are driving, when you are actually even in my sleep. Sometimes something comes to my head and I have a notebook and a pen next to my bed. Without opening my eyes, I jot down something and then develop it later. So writing a poem doesn't really take time, but you need to have the peace of mind. That's the main thing, I think. Once I was interviewed by the Law Society and they asked me, most of the work you do is listening to people's worries and problems all day. How do you go home after that? I said, I never take my jacket home. Those days we used to wear a suit to work every day. But since COVID, it's not happening. So I leave my jacket in the office. In my head, the jacket has all my worries for the day. So I don't take home my worries, come home and, spend the rest of the day with the family without thinking of those things. So it's a strategy that I developed, which I have recommended to the young lawyers. I think that worked because my mind is very clear and I'm generally a happy person, although I write about sad things. So you have to develop a mechanism to deal with these things. We hear horrible stories from clients. Their life stories are not happy ones. But then you have to live your own life as well. You don't bring those problems home. Otherwise, your family life can be affected.
I haven't read any other work of yours other than the recent book of poems, Purple Patch. And I find there is a similarity in Rabindranath Tagore. He also has this, I think he brings the dark side with a humor.
Yeah.
And you tend to have that too. Who were your influences?
See, I was born a Buddhist and I'm still a Buddhist. We learned initially at the local Buddhist temple. My father insisted that I learned Pali and Sanskrit. I can no longer do that. I used to read Pali text. I have also read Tagore quite a bit. I don't know if I have read everything. But It's something that developed over the years. I mean, growing up in a village, not in Colombo, in the village, you see people of all types of families, poor families, families with problems, children who are lacking in, the parents can't afford to buy them the basic things. So I think the empathy and a bit of sadness comes with those experiences. I feel that I should write about them rather than other things. So that's what I have been doing.
You and I are both from the island of Sri Lanka, and there was a civil war which had come to an end. What hope do you have for the country now?
I'm very, very hopeful for a brighter future for the country. One of the things I keep telling my friends now is that we as Sinhalese, we should have been taught Tamil as a language, and the Tamil kids should have been taught Sinhalese. If this was done from the time that Sri Lanka became independent, I think most of these problems could have been avoided. I can speak a little bit of Tamil now because I have a lot of Tamil clients, and some of them don't speak Sinhalese or English, so I have to somehow communicate. But I think the civil war would not have come to that if the politicians had the foresight to accept that we are a multinational country. Everyone has to live their life. And the majority should understand the grievances of the minority. Unfortunately, that did not happen. That's why we lost. I see so many highly educated, bright people living overseas. Some of them are my very good friends in Australia, America, England. These people would not have left the country if not for some of these problems. This is one of the reasons why Sri Lanka did not progress, in my view, myself included. We would have gone back. People still, I mean, now I go 3 times a year and spend time there in the village. A lot of people would love to go back, and they are all hopeful that there is no more corruption. It's a question of the current rulers being able to tackle the economy and the other issues. So there is hope, and I'm very positive about the future for the country.
We heard that during your last visit, you had been to Jaffna and had the opportunity to talk to the students of the law faculty of Jaffna.
I was invited to give a lecture there as a guest lecturer because they wanted to hear the practical side of a legal practice in Australia. And I was delighted to accept the offer. And my wife and I both went there, spent 4 days, had a wonderful time. The kids loved what I had to say. And quite a few of them have been in touch with me by email since then. They thought it was inspiring. And I talked about the Australian legal system, how fair it is, and how we practice. I mean, here I have sued the police a number of times, and I'm still alive. Nothing untoward happens. And the legal system, people are proud of that, and people respect the legal system, judges, and the separation of powers. No politician would dare interfere with a judge or a judgment. These are the basic things of the British legal system. Unfortunately, in Sri Lanka, this failed. But my trip opened my eyes too, because there are so many things we learned, we visited. We went to the Jaffna Library that was burned down, heard some horrific stories about it. And I was so moved that I wrote a poem about it. What I said basically was that you can burn the books, you can burn the building, but you can't burn the thought process. So this is the dark side of human nature, I think. But Sri Lanka can thrive if everyone is united and everyone accepts that everyone is equal.
I was going to conclude this interview by asking you to read a poem of your choice. But now that you had alluded to it, do you mind reading us poem 57 from The Purple Patch, titled They Tried to Burn Thought?
They tried to burn thought. It wasn't just books. It was centuries bound not just in palm leaf and ink, but in blood, in breath. They came not as conquerors, but as cowards, striking at paper because paper does not fight back. They feared what could not be chained. The script of a people, the voice of ancestors, truth older than their laws. Torch in hand, they danced around the fire, thinking it a victory. But what burned that night was not silence. It was memory taking new form. Ash rose into sky, settled in lungs, carried by wind to every child who would one day write again. They scorched the page, not the story. They blackened the holes, not the soul. You cannot kill knowledge by lighting a match. You cannot erase a people with smoke. History will name them the ones who feared ideas and tried to kill them like dogs. But people remember and they rebuild again and again and again.
Beautiful.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maitri Pasugoda. On behalf of SBS Tamil, we wish you all the very best in your future endeavors, your future writings, as well as your legal work. And we thank you very much for the time that you had spent with us. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sanjay. I'm delighted to be able to be a part of the program, and I wish you well.
Virupam, Pagirvu, Karuthu, Parivu. Like, share, comment. SBS Tamil in Facebook.